Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record, program number 302, Side B. It's titled, Walking with the Snake, and veteran listeners will no doubt recognize that title as a reference to a Nazi tract, Serpent's Walk, which I've accessed many times. We're going to touch back on that in a couple of passages that I've dealt with before as something of a jumping-off point to Side 2 of this program. This is being recorded on May 13th. Of the year 2001. One of the things that cued this long inquiry that I've been conducting since December of 1998 into German corporate control over the American media concerns a Nazi tract called Serpent's Walk. This book was published by National Vanguard Books, that's the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important and virulent of domestic Nazi groups. It is the same publishing house that published the book The Turner Diaries, which was the model for the Nazi terrorist group The Order, and also for Timothy McVeigh and company as well in the Oklahoma City bombing. National Vanguard Books also published another book. This is called Serpent's Walk, authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, Calverhall. The book was published in softcover by National Vanguard Books, copyright 1991. This book is about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century. It's executed by the descendants of the SS who infiltrate the U.S. Army and also use an underground capital organization to buy into the American opinion-forming media. The back cover describes this book in part as follows, skipping down. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. As I've stated many times, I believe that this book is not the novel it purports to be, but rather I think it's a blueprint, a manifesto for what the Nazi groups are in fact doing. I think that many of the things that are discussed in this book as being Jewish conspiracies or perpetrated by Israel are in fact going to take place, except they're not going to be perpetrated by Israel. They will be perpetrated by what I believe, what I call the Underground Reich. Another of the reasons that spurred this particular inquiry that I've been conducting for many years concerns the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization that is quite literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground. We've dealt with that in many programs. I'm going to excerpt that book very briefly later on in this program as well. We're going to turn to a couple of passages of the book Serpent's Walk that I've dealt with before. Now, this conversation that is taking place here is between a couple of the Nazi faithful, a gentleman called Wrench, and another fellow called Lessing, who's a former special forces operative turned mercenary, and Lessing eventually becomes converted to the Nazi cause. Wrench here is describing to Lessing how the economic, how the Third Reich went underground and built up its economic component and began buying into the media. We've talked about that before. We're going to review these passages here for the benefit of people that have not heard the program before, because I can appreciate that for newer listeners, what I'm talking about would appear to be utter madness, and I'm sympathetic for that reason. At the end of the broadcast, I'm going to cite a website that has annotated descriptions of these programs and also a couple of other websites that feature real audio archives of many of these programs so people can get caught up. In Serpent's Walk, Wrench describes the going underground, so to speak, of the Third Reich, its use of corporations. Wrench says, the SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places, Bogota, Asunción, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Colombo, Damascus, Dakar, you name it. They realized that the world is heading towards a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will be running everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. We, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. Skipping down. About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a supercorporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, not with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. Skipping down. Speaking of the bad aspects of the Third Reich, we play those aspects down and stress the positive ones instead. The mystique, the scientific approach to racial genetics, the efficiency in organization, the dedication, and the heroism. People will buy that. Skipping down. And speaking of the gradual behavior modification and the image changes that Wrench was talking about. In any case, we're slowly replacing those negative images with others. The good-bad guy routine. What do you think of Jesse James, John Dillinger, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan? Bad guys, maybe, but nobody hates them. It's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. And then Lessing protests, impossible with the Nazis. On Wrench counters, it works with anybody. And once again, Lessing says, you'll never convince enough people to matter. And Wrench says, give it time. Aside from the media, we've been buying up private schools and helping some public ones through philanthropic foundations and working on the churches and the born-agains. Now, note the gradual image changing here, and this is what a psychologist would refer to as behavior modification, desensitization, audiovisual desensitization. And by the way, not incidentally, my own academic background is in psychology. I am going to undertake in the second half of this program, or what's left of it, what is by now fairly commonplace to listeners, namely a speculative line of inquiry. In the past, we've dealt with a couple of Nation magazine articles about the Bertelsmann firm. Bertelsmann's patriarch, Heinrich Mohn, was a member of the SS. The Bertelsmann firm was part of the Himmlerkreis, the Himmler circle of friends that financed the day-to-day workings of the SS. And there are indications that Bertelsmann is, in all probability, a Bormann company, part of the Bormann Flight Capital Group, and part of the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization. It is also the third largest media corporation in the world, and it's a major, major focal point of these broadcasts. Once again, for the benefit of people that have not heard the other programs in this series, there are other broadcasts available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. You can visit their website at spitfirelist.com. It's equipped with real audio. You can write to them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, or email them at mail@spitfirelist.com. And I'll repeat that address, time permitting. There also are a couple of web addresses of sister station WFMU-FM, which are equipped with real audio. One of them is wfmu.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. There are links to both web addresses from the Spitfire website. Interestingly enough, Bertelsmann has given a number of indications, as I said, that its Nazi past is not as far in the past as some people might like to have us believe. One of the articles that indicated that was an article by John Friedman and Hirsch Fischler. This is an article from The Nation magazine. It is from The Nation of 11-8-99. It's headlined, Bertelsmann's Revisionist, and it deals with Dirk Bavendam, who was hired as the official house historian for Bertelsmann. There are a number of interesting things about Dirk Bovendom. He would appear to be a very interesting historian indeed. I'm going to review a couple of aspects of this article, and then I'm going to stress a particular aspect which I think dovetails in a very interesting fashion, albeit a speculative one, with an article that appeared in the New York Times just this past week. Bovendom, again the official house historian for Bertelsmann, has a very interesting perspective on history. And bear in mind, too, the book Serpent's Walk, in which history is gradually turned around by this underground Reich. This is part of the battle for the hearts and minds of the American people, which is waged prior to taking over the United States. Bovendom has written of World War II and the Third Reich. Speaking of him, Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman write, his book, Roosevelt's Way to War, Roosevelt's Weg zum Krieg, was published in 1983. Rewriting history, he stated that Roosevelt, not Hitler, had caused World War II. He also wrote that American Jews, quote, controlled most of the media, unquote, and he claimed they gave a false picture of Hitler, skipping down. In a second book, Roosevelt's War, published in 1993, reissued in 1998, Bovendom accuses the U.S. president of enacting a plan to start World War II. In the same book, he suggests that Hitler's threats in early 1939 against European Jewry were a reaction to Roosevelt's strategy against Germany. And in a previous section of this particular article, there's discussion of Dirk Bovendom and his verification of some fraudulent materials which supposedly were drawings by Adolf Hitler. And these drawings, and Hitler was an artist, these drawings make Hitler out to be sort of a kinder, gentler Adolf Hitler. And that is the analysis of some paintings, some watercolors by Adolf Hitler that have come to be the focal point of a major lawsuit, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But again, with regard to the remaking of the image of the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler, and the gradual behavior modification, the gradual changing of the image that is discussed in an allegedly hypothetical fashion in Serpent's Walk, note the following, and note, interestingly enough, Dirk Bovendom's role in authenticating these fraudulent and to a certain extent, at least from a psychological standpoint, exculpatory drawings allegedly by Hitler. In 1980, Bertelsmann's Stern magazine published poems and illustrations supposedly written and drawn by Hitler during World War I under the title Rhymes by Private First Class H. Dirk Bovendom, a 61-year-old German historian who had been instrumental in helping Stern obtain the material, wrote an accompanying article noting that the poems and drawings show Hitler as an ordinary soldier. In one illustration, a German soldier gently holds a baby. In another, a soldier helps a mother lying in bed while a baby nestles in a cradle. Subsequently, the poems and drawings were determined to be forgeries. Later, Mohn, that's Reinhard Mohn, the son of SS Bertelsmann Patriarch Heinrich Mohn. Later, Mohn gave the green light to a Bertelsmann division to purchase the Hitler diaries by the same forger, which also showed a milder Hitler. They were published in Stern in 1983. Now, again, note that these drawings portray a kinder, gentler Adolf Hitler. It turns out that they were fraudulent, but they were vouched for as authentic by Dirk Bovendom. And note also the passage in Serpent's Walk, which talks about the gradual remaking of the image of the Third Reich, and note here where Rentsch says, we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. And note that he says, it's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. And that's something that's very worth bearing in mind. And we're going to listen now to an article about a lawsuit that has been filed in the United States. And this lawsuit may wind up costing the U.S. taxpayers about $100 million. And this is a lawsuit to oblige the owner of, which is the United States government, of some watercolors by Adolf Hitler, to turn the watercolors back over to the daughter of the personal photographer of Adolf Hitler. And we're going to take a look at some of the interesting heritage of not only Henrietta von Schirach, the daughter of Heinrich Hoffmann, who was Hitler's personal photographer, but we're also going to take a look at where the profits from Mr. Hoffman's or Herr Hoffman's photographs went to, and we're going to take a look at some interesting networking vis-a-vis Henrietta von Schirach, the widow of Balder von Schirach, who was the leader of the Hitler Youth, and who was introduced to Heinrich Hoffmann by Henrietta Hoffmann, I should say, Henrietta Hoffmann was Henrietta Hoffmann, yes, was introduced to Balder von Schirach by his Heinrich Hoffmann's secretary, who was Eva Braun. Excuse me, this is sort of an incestuous relationship here. Not incestuous, but let's just say it's a small circle of friends, as folk singer Tom Rush used to put it, and a very interesting circle this is. Now, a lot of people dismiss some of the paths of inquiry that I engage in on this program as conspiracy. It's certainly a loaded word. Consider another word, which is networking, because I think it's a much more realistic and much more objective term. And just forget about the term conspiracy. Think about the term networking. And if you are considering wasteful government spending or a misuse of taxpayer monies, consider how about $100 million of American taxpayers' money may be spent to compensate the widow of the leader of the Hitler Youth for some paintings that were owned by her father, the official photographer for Adolf Hitler, who owned a bunch of Hitler's watercolors. This is from the New York Times of Tuesday, May 8th of the year 2001, at Dateline Washington, May 7th. It's headlined, Court Considers Ownership of Seized Hitler Paintings, and it reads in part as follows. In a climate-controlled basement downtown, at a location that the United States Army has insisted on keeping secret since the end of World War II, is a carefully executed, traditional watercolor of a quaint, empty courtyard. Standing 16 by 21 inches, it lies in a steel-gray cabinet along with three others by the same hand. The government maintains that the very brush strokes of the painter have such incendiary potential that they must be guarded from the gaze of all but screened experts. They are signed A. Hitler, unquote. But the need to keep them hidden is challenged in a lawsuit that has been making its way through the courts for 18 years, and was heard today in the Federal Appeals Court here, where a panel of three judges barely let lawyers state their cases before subjecting them to a barrage of questions on jurisdiction, statutes of limitation, and other technical matters. The name Hitler was never mentioned. His artworks were discreetly referred to as the watercolors, unquote. The paintings were owned by Hitler's friend and personal photographer Heinrich Hoffmann, and confiscated as propaganda after the war, along with Hoffman's vast archive of photographs. The 2.5 million photographs include rare images of Hitler rehearsing his flamboyant style of oratory, as well as various intimate moments. The United States seized the material, along with thousands of other Nazi artworks. They were used as evidence at the Nuremberg war crimes trials, and then sent to Washington. In the 1950s, most were returned to Germany, leaving only a few hundred deemed the most inflammatory in the secret vault. The complaint, brought by the photographer's heirs and a Texas collector, contends that the Hoffman material has long since lost its power to incite and should be returned not to Germany, but to the plaintiffs. They say the military promised Hoffman that he would get his property back. Thus, the lawsuit says the works are being wrongfully retained, unquote, tantamount to theft because of politics, unquote. The United States is arguing its case mainly on narrow legal grounds, that federal statutes and post-war agreements with the Germans allowed it to seize German property, and that all deadlines for restitution claims passed long ago. But Jeffrey Axelrod, a senior lawyer at the Justice Department who has led the government's defense for more than a decade, said that an overarching principle applied. The United States government is entitled to retain Hitler memorabilia, which came into our nation's possession because we won the war, unquote. And the next opinion, the next legal opinion presented in this case is, to my mind, even more interesting and significant, and I think it's to be considered in light of the desire on the part of the plaintiffs to get these paintings back. It is to be considered in the light, I think, of the fraudulent drawings approved by Bertelsmann's house historian. They are authenticated by Bertelsmann's house historian, Dirk Bobendam, that presented a kinder, gentler Adolf Hitler. And I think it is to be considered in the context of the gradual remaking of the image of the Nazis presented in Serpent's Walk. Listen to the following. Others go further. In an affidavit for the United States, Sybil H. Milton, M-I-L-T-O-N, an authority on Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, argued that the paintings and photographs, quote, make Hitler look harmless, and they could be used to disguise the horror and murderous brutality of Nazi Germany, unquote. Her statement was submitted before her death from cancer last year. Mr. Axelrod was drawn into the case in 1989 when a district court in Texas ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. He was outraged, he said, that the court would allow the Hoffman heirs to wait beyond the 2-year statute of limitations until they found someone who could litigate the cause for them, or the case for them, unquote. The reference is to the unlikely alliance of Hoffman's daughter, Henrietta, and Billy Price, a wealthy American collector of Hitler memorabilia with a fascination for trying to understand the dictator's personality. The daughter was once married to Balder von Schirach, the architect of Hitler's powerhouse youth movement, and part of the intimate circle in which the Nazi leader forged his public persona. Hoffman served not only as Hitler's photographer, but also as his confidant and public speaking coach. Hitler met his future mistress, Eva Braun, during visits to the Hoffman studio where she worked. And skipping down, in time, the photographs and paintings went their separate ways. The photographs, some 2.5 million images of Germany from the 1860s to a few days before Hitler committed suicide in 1945, were transferred to the National Archives and have been accessible to the public ever since. The paintings were retained by the Army Center of Military History. The Hoffman Archive is contained in albums filled with contact prints, glass plate negatives, miscellaneous prints, and nearly 500 rolls of 35mm nitrate negatives. Fritz Redlich, an emeritus professor of psychiatry at Yale University and the author of Hitler, Diagnosis of a Destructive Prophet, who interviewed Hoffman's daughter, said, Hoffman had absolute access to Hitler and could capture his whims, prejudices, and character. Noting the propagandistic nature of the work, he added, he could also manipulate the images to create whatever impression he wished, unquote. Hoffman was tried by a German court as a Nazi profiteer. He had received huge royalties for the use of his photographs and imprisoned for 5 years. After his release, he sought to retain what the Americans had seized. He died in 1957, and his daughter pursued the claim. Decades later, when Mr. Price, the Texas collector, was researching his privately published book, Adolf Hitler, the Unknown Artist, he learned of the confiscated Hitler material and Hoffman's daughter. And, skipping down, but Mr. Price and the surviving heirs, the daughter died in 1992, are now seeking $99 million in damages for having been denied the use of the material for so many years. So note that if he wins this case, $100 million will be going to Mr. Price, the heirs of Heinrich Hoffman and Balder von Schirach. Very, very interesting indeed. We're going to take a look now at Balder von Schirach, Heinrich Hoffman, and Heinrich Hoffman's photographs, and you're going to hear a very familiar name when we discuss who was in charge of the economics surrounding Heinrich Hoffman's photographs. First of all, we should stress that in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning, copyright or published in 1981 by Lyle Stewart Incorporated, the continuity between the Third Reich and the post-war underground Reich, as I call it, is stressed and documented to an extensive degree. The finances of Nazi Germany were completely under the control of Martin Bormann, not only the administration of the German civilian economy, but also party finances as well. And this gave Martin Bormann micro-control, so to speak, over all of the financial aspects of the Third Reich. Now, bear in mind that Heinrich Hoffmann's heirs and Mr. Price are looking to get their hands on roughly $100 million of U.S. taxpayer monies, and one of the expert legal opinions in this case discussed or voiced the opinion that these photographs, or these paintings rather, the property of Hitler's personal photographer, who was sentenced for war crimes as a propagandist, could paint a kinder, gentler image of Adolf Hitler. Talking about the control of Martin Bormann over all of the financial aspects of the Third Reich, Paul Manning writes as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. With such monies under his control, Bormann now held power of the purse over all the other Nazi leaders, including even the Gauleiters who ran the party machinery across Germany. All looked to Bormann for their annual funding. Skipping down, Eva Braun received her monthly checks in Munich, where she worked as a secretary for Heinrich Hoffmann, Hitler's official photographer. Bormann also collected fees for the worldwide sale of Hoffmann's pictures of the Führer. So basically, the agent collecting fees for the sale of photographs of Heinrich Hoffmann, none other than Martin Bormann. It is probable that any monies that were derived from the publicizing of Hitler's paintings would also have been under Bormann's control, and it's a pretty safe bet that any monies that derived from this lawsuit will ultimately go to the Bormann Organization, and perhaps those monies could be used, or the paintings rather, could be used for the rehabilitation of the image of Adolf Hitler a la Serpent's Walk, a la Dirk Bovendam. We're going to turn now briefly, as a concluding element in our discussion, to a book I've used before on this program. It's titled Quest, subtitled Searching for the Truth of Germany's Nazi Past. It's co-authored by Ib Melchior and Frank Brandenburg, published in softcover by the Presidio Press and copyright 1990. Frank Brandenburg was a young German who was researching Germany's Nazi past. In that capacity, he befriended Karl Wolff, Himmler's personal adjutant and an SS general, and one of the most important people in the SS, who gave him his SS Death's Head ring and basically made a bunch of introductions on behalf of Frank Brandenburg in the cosmology, so to speak, of the Third Reich. He basically introduced Frank Brandenburg to some of the top personalities in the Third Reich, at least those who were surviving. In Quest, there's discussion of Balder von Schirach, whose widow Henrietta Hoffmann was. Balder von Schirach was the son of a German aristocrat and his American wife, whose ancestors included two signatories of the Declaration of Independence. Balder joined the party in 1924 and became an avid anti-Semite after reading The International Jew by Henry Ford. He worshipped the Führer, and in 1931 he was appointed Reich Youth Leader of the NSDAP. 2 years later, at the age of 26, he was made Leader of the Youth and of the German Reich, an organization which by 1936 had over 6 million members. He was Leader of the Youth of the German Reich. He married Henrietta Hoffmann, daughter of Adolf Hitler's original biographer, or photographer, excuse me, Heinrich Hoffmann. And in being introduced to Henrietta von Schirach, Henrietta Hoffmann, Frank Brandenburg was introduced to her by a fellow named Heinrich Heim, who was Himmler's personal adjutant. Karl Wolff described him as follows. One more thing, he said, keeping his voice low as if to prevent it from carrying into the living room. If you are that interested in Reichsleiter Bormann, you might try to talk to Heim, Ministerial Dirigent Heinrich Heim. He lives in Munich, in the Schwabing district, on Ungerstrasse, I believe. He looked closely at Frank. He was Bormann's adjutant, had an honorary rank in the SS, SS Standartenführer, or SS Colonel, I believe, and I understand he has several papers written by the Reichsleiter in 1945, which he tells me have never been seen by Allied authorities. So this was Himmler's personal adjutant who introduced Balder von Schirach to Henrietta Hoffmann. Henrietta von Schirach. I know Henrietta von Schirach, Heim said slowly. The widow of Reichsjugendfuhrer, Reich youth leader Balder von Schirach. She lives here in Munich, unquote. He looked at Frank, and, of course, there is Albert Bormann, Martin Bormann's brother, Gruppenführer Albert Bormann. He, too, lives here. I can give you his telephone number. So, of course, it proves nothing, but the introductions made to Henrietta von Schirach were made by Himmler's personal, or Bormann's personal adjutant, who also knew Bormann's brother. So again, some interesting networking and perhaps some reworking of the image of the Third Reich. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 302, Walking with the Snake. This is being recorded on May 13th of 2001. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.